This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
ויהי איש מבנימין ושמו קיש בן אביאל בן צורר בן בחרס בן אפיח בן איש ימיני גיבור חיל. We are introduced in the opening sentence of chapter 9 to a man from the tribe of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Aviel, the son of Tzurur, the son of Bechoras, the son of Afiach, the son of Ishimini, who was a powerful man. V'lo hayovein, and he had a son, Ushmoy Shaul, his name was Shaul, Saul. Bachur Vatoiv. Bachur means young, and Bachur means chosen, outstanding, exceptional, and it has both of those meanings here, Vatoiv and good. V'ein ish mibnei Yisrael toiv mimenu. Look at those credentials. And this is not a credential written by his boss or by his subordinate. This is written by the Tanakh itself. There was no man among the people of Israel that was as good as he. So we have here the finest that the Jewish people have to offer. Shaul at that stage of our history was the greatest, the most outstanding, the most exceptional young man in the whole of the nation. Thanks. You're a bit confused on the papers. Are there a few that are coming around now? You should have Chapter 9, verse 1. How many pages do you have? Can I just see a batch of papers? Thanks. You should have three pages. The first one, the bottom left-hand word of the first one should be and. The top left-hand word should be make. That's the first page. The second page, the top left-hand word is eat. And there should be a third page. Does anybody have the third page? You're missing a first page there. How many people are missing a first page? Okay, here we have a batch of first pages looking for owners. So down towards the bottom of that first page, about 10 or 12 lines from the bottom, you have the beginning of chapter 9, and that's where we are. So this man Saul is the most outstanding of the people of Israel. Mishichmoy v'malo gavoyo michol ha'om. From his shoulders and up, he was taller than any other person. So that gives us a sense of his physical stature. He was at least a head taller than the next tallest person, and it also gives a sense of his moral and intellectual stature. But there is certainly an emphasis here on his physical appearance, which is important. Once again, we have an indication that the Torah does not in any way underplay the importance of appearance. And we've discussed certain aspects of that in the past. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that today, but clearly we touched on it last week, the element of dignity, stature. It is very difficult for a person to command dignity and stature if he doesn't represent it, if he doesn't present it in his physical appearance. Now, people can do a fair amount with their physical appearance. They can have themselves groomed, and they can have themselves image made to some degree to match the role that they need to take, but we see that it is important, and there's some things that there is no substitute. Height is an enormous advantage. There's just no question about it. If somebody's tall in a position of authority, that is a tremendous advantage. If somebody is handsome, if he's good looking, that is a tremendous advantage. If a woman is beautiful, that is a tremendous advantage. One cannot get away from that. That's just a fact of life. It is true that most people don't utilize their assets anywhere near their potential. But there are a lot of people, many, many people, most people, who could look a lot more dignified than they do, who could look a lot more beautiful and a lot more handsome than they do, if they would put a little bit more effort and thoughtfulness into the way they appear. But Shaul, even without having to have put anything into it, he naturally had that look of class and of dignity and of stature that was a true expression. And that too is a very important thing. It doesn't really help. I've seen pictures and television, and on television some of these very tall basketball players. They are very tall. They don't have stature. They don't necessarily have stature. Height is not a guarantee of stature. If you have stature, it helps to be tall. If you don't have stature, it doesn't make any difference whether you're tall or you're short. But if the physical form is an accurate representation of what the person is, it just magnifies and amplifies that being, that existence. And Shaul had it. He had the intelligence, he had the moral stature, he had the purity, and he had the physical stature. And the donkeys of Kish, the father of Shaul, got lost. Vayomer Kish el Shaul beno, and Kish said to Saul his son, very strange that a man of such stature and such accomplishment should be told by his father, Kach lo itcho es achad me'anorim, take one of the boys, take one of the servants, v'kum lech bakesh es ha'asunos, and go and look for the donkeys, and try and find the asses. Vayavor b'har Ephraim, and he traveled through the mountains of Ephraim, Vayavor be'eret shalisho v'loy motso, and they traveled through the land of Shalisho and they could not find the donkeys. Vayavru be'eret sha'alim v'ayin, they traveled through the land of Sha'alim, they couldn't find the donkeys. Vayavor be'eret yamini v'loy motso, they traveled through the whole of the territory of Binyamin and they were not able to find the asses. Donkeys were lost. They got as far as the land of Tzuf. And Shaul said to his young boy who was with him, it's time to give up. We've tried, we've looked, we've traveled, we've searched. There's no sign of the donkeys. Let us now return, because what will happen is my father will stop worrying about the donkeys and he'll start worrying about us. So there comes a time where you've got to say, it's not worth it, we've tried, let's give it up and let's get home so that my father won't worry about us. And the servant said to him, before we turn back, says the servant, there is a man of God in the city. And the man is respectable, honorable. It's known that whatever he does, whatever he says, whatever he speaks, comes true. So there's this mystic here, he's a man of God. Let us go to him. Very interesting phrase. Perhaps, he says, this man will tell us about the journey along which we have traveled. Notice, what are they going to him for? Are they going to ask about the future or the past? The past. Now, this is not a fortune teller. They're not going to ask him where the donkeys are. You don't go to a man of God to say, where's my donkey? You don't go to a man of God to say, I've lost my motor vehicle, do you know where it is? You don't do that. You don't go to a man of God to say, tell me my fortune, tell me the future. You go to a fortune teller for that, or you look at the astrological pages of the daily newspaper. That's if you want to ask about the future, that's what you do. It's absurd. What do you go to a man of God about? Perhaps he'll tell us at Darkeinu Asher Elachnu Aleihu, he'll tell us about the way along which we have already come. That's what's really important to know. Why is that so important? What's important to know? What they want to find out is, why? Why have we been led on this trail? Why has God done this to us? There's some purpose in this. Donkeys get lost and they've disappeared into thin air. We have combed the territory. It's not possible that we haven't found the donkeys. There's something weird, there's something unusual about this. Let's find out why this has happened. Not where it's leading to, not where we're going to, not where we're finding the donkeys. That's not the issue. The issue is, why has this happened to us? Let's understand the moral in it. Let us understand the reasoning behind it. Let us understand the intellect behind it. Vayomer Shaul and Aaron, Shaul said to his young servant, "Hinei Melech." Okay, we'll go to the man of God. Umanovilish. What will we come with? Ki halechem azal mikelenu. The food that we brought, we finished already. We've been away longer than we expected. We don't have any food. And we have no payment to bring to the man of God. What will be with us? And the servant answered Shaul once again and said, I've got a quarter of a shekel of silver with me. We'll give that to the man of God. He gid lono es darkeinu, and he will explain us our journey to us. Lefonim be Yisrael. Just before that, there is an understanding, there is an acceptance that you don't impose on a person without offering him compensation. He doesn't owe them anything, and to ask him to give up with his time, there has to be some form of compensation. And they wouldn't dream of going to him. Shaul would not have thought, wouldn't have entered his mind to go to the man of God without coming with something. The man of God might well have said, "Please don't worry, I don't need anything from you. I don't need a gift from you, I don't need..." That's his prerogative. But it's the person imposing's responsibility to make sure that he comes with something, he comes with an offering, he comes with something in his hand. And that's something that we touched on once before, but it's something severely lacking in today's generation in a number of different areas. But one of the areas, in fact, is in the religious area, where there is an assumption that Torah is for nothing. There's an assumption that Torah is free of charge. Nothing worthwhile is free. When we say that nothing is for nothing, that's not true. There are things that are for nothing. But nothing valuable is for nothing. And if one has an expectation, if something is valuable to one, there must be a willingness to invest. To invest in some form or other, something. To show a gesture, something that an individual shows, I'm willing to put something into it as well. There are many reasons for it, and I think that part of the reason for it is that to some degree Torah became commercialized. Remember, we talked about when things become institutionalized and when religion becomes a business. When religion becomes a business, then the recipient, the student, becomes the customer. And that's dangerous. That's not the relationship. In studying, it's happened in all educational institutions, in this country, in other countries, the student is the customer. That isn't really the way it's supposed to be. It's not a customer-supplier relationship. Because in learning, the customer cannot be king. If the customer is king, he cannot learn. A king can't learn from a servant. You need to learn from a king. So in teaching, the supplier is king, not the customer. And that relationship has been distorted with an enormous cost involved in that distortion. We find it in all areas, in colleges, in universities, where the student has his rights and he demands and what he wants and what he wants to study and how he wants to study and how it must be presented, and he rates his lectures. Should be rating of lecture. But again, man's teaching, he's an expert in his field. You want to come, you come. You don't want to come, you don't come. That's how you rate him. You don't attend. For you to rate the expert. And there's been a whole shift in that emphasis, and in the religious in the religious area as well, where there is a sense that by attending a shiur, I'm doing enough of a favor already. I'm coming to a shiur, so the rabbi can say he had 100 people this week, and it's thanks to me. I was one of those 100. That's all I need to do. Forget it. That's not the relationship. That's not what it's meant to be. Torah is valuable, and therefore there is an understanding and assumption on the part of Shaul and his servant. There's no way they would go to this man without coming to something within it, coming with something in hand. When people go to consult a rabbi, have you ever heard of them offering to pay? Heard of it occasionally. Sometimes it happens, but very rarely. This guy wants to ask the rabbi a shayla. Does he come with a gift? Does he say, how much does that cost, rabbi? No, sometimes the rabbi says, you know, that I've got to make a call to Jerusalem to discuss that. It's a difficult question. What does the person say? Sure, fine, you know, tell me when you've got the answer. Not let me know how much that costs you, or come and phone from my telephone. There is an assumption, there is an entitlement when it comes to religion that it's important to see Shaul did not share. If I'm going to impose on this man, he's an expert, he's got better things to do with his life than answer my question about the donkeys. If I'm going to impose upon him to answer my question about the donkeys, what am I going to do for him? How am I going to reciprocate? How am I going to show appreciation? How am I going to compensate for him? And if I cannot, I will not go, says Shaul. There's no way I'll go to this man if I can't come with something in my hand. Says the servant, I've got a quarter of a shekel. It's not very much, but at least we can show a gesture. At least we can demonstrate that we're willing to come. We're not asking for something for nothing. Mefonim b'Yisrael, in verse 9 we're told, in the earlier days in Israel, this is what a man would say when he went to seek God, when he went to ask counsel from a man of God. Let us go to the Re'eh, to the seer. Because the person that today we call a prophet, in the olden days, before this time, used to be called the vision, the visioner, the person who could see. That's how he was related to, that's how they saw him, that's how they talked of him as the seer. So Shaul says to his young boy, well, okay, we're here, there's a man of God here, there's this vision, we've got something to give him, let us go. And they went to the city in which the man of God was. They were just walking up the town, up towards the town. Can you imagine on those hills in Israel, of which you have so many in the villages on the slopes of the hills, so as you approach a village, you're walking up into a village, which is what they did. And as they walked in, this magnificent Shaul, his beauty, his stature, the way he presented himself and bore himself, and his servant walk up into this village, and they find a group of young girls walking out of the village to go and draw water. And they stop the girls and say, is this the place where the seer is? And they answered them, and they said, you're right, he's right before you, you're going in the correct direction. Maher, be fast. Atok now ki ayom bo loyu, because he came to our village this day. Ki zeva chayim lom babo, because there's going to be a public sacrifice today. Kevreachem oyu, when you come into the village, kentin tsuno, so you'll find him right there. But terem yale abamo, so you'll find him just before he goes onto the stage. Lechol to eat ki loyechala omagoy, because the people won't eat until he comes. Ki hu yovorech hazeva, because he says the bracha. Acherechem yechlu akruim. Then the people eat. You notice at Kiddush on Shabbos, nobody eats before Kiddush. People gather around and they stand and wait until the rabbi makes Kiddush, and then everybody eats. That's how it was then too. The ato alu, now go up, because you're lucky, today you will find him. Quite a long answer to the question of, does the visionary live here? Is this the place to find the rare? Long story about the sacrifice, and he's just come today, and he's about to go there, and he makes the brocha, and the people won't eat until he's made the brocha. A long discussion they have, which we'll discuss. And they went into the city. They were just coming into the city. And Shmuel was walking out towards them, to get onto the stage. And Hashem revealed the ear of Shmuel. One day before Shaul arrived, Hashem told Shmuel, Lemo, saying, "Ka'es machor, this time tomorrow, Eshlach elecho ish me'eretz Binyamin. I will send to you a man from the land of Binyamin. U'meshachto l'nogid al ami Yisrael, and you shall anoint him as a king over my people Israel. V'hoshia es ami miyad plishtim, he will save my people from the plishtim. Ki ro'isi es ami, for I have seen my people, ki bo'otza akoso eloi, because their cry has come to me. The story goes on of how Shmuel invites the young men to the sacrifice and offers them a place of honor. Shmuel says in verse 21, Yisrael, I come from the smallest of the tribes, and my family is the youngest of the families. Why do you talk to me so respectfully? And Shmuel takes Shaul and his young boy and brings him to the little office, gives them a place at the top of the table, gives him a very special portion. And in the verse 27, at the end of the chapter, Hema Yodim Bikse Hoir, they were walking away from the banquet at the edge of the city, Ushmuel Omar al Shaul, and Shmuel said to Shaul, Emol Lanar Vayavo Lefaneinu, tell the young man to walk ahead. I don't want him to overhear what I'm going to tell you. Vayavo, and the young man went ahead. Vata Amoid Kayoy, and you stand where you are today. Vashmiacho Estevar Elohim, and I will tell you the word of God. And he proceeds to tell Shaul in the next chapter that God has appointed him as a king. Very peculiar story, very colorful, and a very strange story of how Shaul came to be the king. As the shepherd boy, and the shepherd theme comes up very often. Moshe was a shepherd, David was a shepherd, Shaul's a shepherd. We've had leaders who were shepherds, we'll discuss that. And purely by chance, by pure coincidence, it would appear. If one believes in coincidences, and coincidences are difficult things to believe in, you know, it's hard to believe in God, but to believe in coincidence is absurd. So the choice is to believe in something difficult or to believe in something absurd. And one would say coincidence. The asses got lost, he goes to look for them, he travels all over the place, can't find them, lands up in this village, bumps into Shmuel, and Shmuel says, "Ah! You're a good man for king. You be king from tomorrow." Very strange story. Let's analyze some of it. There is a medrash which I'm going to learn with you that says the following. This medrash refers to the scene just before the burning bush. Now this is a very important moment in Jewish history. The Jews are in Egypt, slaves. God has not communicated with them for hundreds of years. Moshe was raised in the court of Pharaoh, murders an Egyptian, flees, lands up helping some young girls at a well in the land of Midian, marries one of the girls, and becomes manager of his father-in-law's business. That's Moshe's early career. We talk of Moses, we talk of Moshe always as the man who took us out of Egypt and so on, but we've got to not forget that until the age of 80, Moshe was a business manager. That was his career, that was his job. His first 80 years, he was, as a young man, he grew up in the house of Pharaoh, and during his middle age and his latter years, until the age of 80, till retirement age, a good old retirement age, Moshe was in business. He took care of the empire of his father-in-law, Yisro. And Yisro was in the sheep business, which in those days was in that particular area, was a big business. What happened? Vayinhag esatzon achar hamidbar. Moshe takes the flock into the desert. Now you figure out, for a shepherd to make that choice, there are pastures and there's desert. Desert similar to the desert that you've got out if you travel down the Highway 10. You get those open places with a little tuft of grass here and a little tuft of grass there. Figure out what kind of area you need per lamb if you're in the desert as opposed to if you're in a cultivated area. In South Africa we have a desert area called the Karoo, and I know that my grandfather was a sheep farmer in that area, so I know how much territory you need over there, which is similar to here. It's an acre per lamb. So you can figure out, if you've got tens of thousands of lambs, how many acres of territory you need for those lambs. Why does he take them to the desert? Why doesn't he rather keep them in the cultivated area where he can keep them closer? It's less difficult for him to take care of, less traveling time for him, easier for him to see, to keep them all under control. Why does he go to a place where he's going to have to cover vast distances in order to feed all these sheep? Says the Medrash, for one simple reason. Lohotzion min hagezer, because there's no chance of theft there. The desert doesn't belong to anybody. So wherever they graze, they're entitled to be eating. If they're in cultivated areas and one lamb wanders off to a field that doesn't belong to the owner, he's stealing. He's feeding his sheep on somebody else's territory. And that Moshe didn't want to be involved in. So he would rather be involved in a business that required enormous traveling and long distances and hardship and no water and nowhere to stay. Imagine what it was, the great Moshe, stuck in the desert with tens of thousands of sheep and having to take care of them in those desert conditions. Why? So that there wouldn't be a risk of theft. That's what he does. He doesn't say to himself, you know, I've got to study Torah, so I've got to have minions, so I must be near a shul, and the Shabbos, so I can't be too far. That's not the first condition. My first condition is, I'm a business manager. That's my job. And therefore my first responsibility is to make sure that what I'm doing doesn't come anywhere near theft. It would be nice to daven with a minion, but if I can't daven with a minion, it's a luxury I can't afford. It would be nice to be close to a shul on Shabbos. If I can't be close to a shul on Shabbos, it's a luxury I can't afford. But the avoidance of theft is not a luxury. The avoidance of theft is a necessity without which I'm not willing to live. If I have to compromise my business into a risk of theft, I would rather not be in it altogether. So I have no choice, says Moshe. I have to be in the desert. That's his... When Moshe weighs up risk, it's not just business risk, it's moral risk as well. Just as risky. If you're weighing up a business risk, the worst that can happen if you make an error of judgment, the worst that can happen is you lose your money. You can lose all your money. And that's very serious and very unpleasant. But your soul is still intact. If you make a bad moral judgment in business, you can lose your soul as well. And that risk Moshe is not prepared to take. That's Jewish business. What is the outcome of that? He's in the desert, and we're told now in a different medrash when Moshe was taking care of the flock of Yisrael in the desert, Barach mimenu gedi, a little goat ran away. Some of you will know the story. Veratz acharev ad shehigia lechasis. And Moshe pursued that goat. He ran in the hot desert. The elderly Moshe ran and ran and ran, chasing the goat. Why did he do that? Why didn't he just say, one goat, not the end of the world? Why didn't he say, I've got thousands of sheep to look after, why should I run after the goat? So he must have had managers. He must have had subordinates. So he could have said, you take care of the sheep while I run after the goat. Why didn't he say, I'll take care of the sheep, you run after the goat? See the moral standing of Moshe? It's not their job to run. That's not what they were hired for. They were hired to stand in one place to take care of the sheep. If somebody has to run after the goat, it had better be me. There's nobody else. So I'll run after the goat. They can take care of it. So Moshe has made certain moral judgments that have cost him a lot. He's in the desert instead of in cultivated areas. And he's now running after a lost goat in the heat of the desert. woman she gets lechassis nizdam lemo breicha shemayim. There was a little oasis there at Chassis, a little pool of water. For omad agdi lishtos, and the goat stopped to drink. Kivan shigia Moshe etzlo. The great Moshe comes up to the pool and sees the little goat drinking at the pool. What does he say? Lo ayisi yodea sheratz ayisa mipnei tzoma. I didn't know why you were running, he says to the goat. I thought you were rebellious. I didn't know you were just thirsty. Ayefa tor, now you must be terribly tired. If you were running to something that you thought was better, a better life, you wouldn't be tired. If you were running because you were a rebellious goat, you wouldn't be tired, you would be full of fun. But if you're running because you're thirsty, you must be exhausted. Hilkivo al kasefoi, he put the goat on his shoulders, v'hoyo mahalich, and he carried the goat back. Very undignified. He did it, he empathized with the goat. The same medrash, another story. King David was a shepherd, and Hayom Menea Hagadolu Mipnei Haktanim, where he used to feed the sheep, he used to take the strong sheep and hold them back so that the weaker sheep could get forward. But Hayom Meitzi Haktanim Liris, he used to take the little ones out first, Kadesh Yiru Esev Harach, so that the little ones could get the soft grass. Da'acharkach Meitzi Azakelim, and then he would bring the bigger ones out. So that they could eat the medium sized, the older sheep used to then eat the medium grass. Then he would bring out the middle, the young, strong ones, to eat the harder grass. He reversed the natural process. The natural process is survival of the fittest. The natural process is the strongest ones get there first and they eat the best grass. And then the older ones get there and some survive and some can't because the grass is getting too hard. And then the babies come and most of them die. That's the natural process. But David HaMelech, King David, who's not yet a king at that time, he's still a shepherd, realizes that that natural process is not in the commercial interests of the owner. That's all right on safari, that's all right in the jungle. But it's not okay for an owner of sheep. He wants maximum survival rate. So as the shepherd, he makes sure that the little ones eat first, and then the older ones eat, and that the strong ones eat last, because they're the ones who can most easily survive on the leftover grass.
Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Hashem, Mishu hu yodea liros hatzon ish lefi kocho yavo v'yireh ba'ami.
A man who understands sheep so well, a man who understands the different strengths of which sheep needs which kind of food, and he arranges that the right one gets the right kind of food, is fit to be a king for my people. Why? Why, if you're a good shepherd, are you going to be a good king? Why, if you understand sheep, are you going to understand people? The biggest danger in leadership is the tendency to treat everybody equally. That's the biggest danger. And that's how you destroy a nation. When you start treating everybody equally. Because everybody isn't equal. And everybody shouldn't be treated equally. Everybody should have the opportunity for equality. Everybody should have equal opportunity. But what people make of that opportunity should determine how they're treated. Once I've given you opportunity and you opportunity, and you've taken the opportunity and invested in it and grown and developed, am I to treat you the same as the person who's done nothing with the opportunity? Who's wasted the opportunity, destroyed the opportunity? Why should I treat you the same? Treating everybody equally is the biggest danger of leadership. And God says, if you know how not to treat sheep equally, you'll know how not to treat people equally. The greatest quality that God seeks in a leader is the capacity to differentiate between people. Capacity to offer everybody the same opportunity, but not to treat them equally. Treat them equally means old sheep, young sheep, middle-aged sheep, go for it, guys, whoever gets there first, survival of the fittest. That's not okay, that's not moral, that's not ethical. Because they don't have the same opportunity. If you put the old lamb, and you put the young lamb, and you say go for it, that's not equal opportunity. That's unequal opportunity. You need to hold the old lamb back. You need to hold the strong lamb back and let the older one or let the babies go forward so that they can have equal opportunity. Of Of course, that's one of the moral arguments for affirmative action programs. That if there is somebody who hasn't had an opportunity, you can't just say, well, now it's all equal, now it's all okay, everybody go for it. We have to make sure that the playing fields are level before the game starts, and if they're not, we've got to compensate. You don't treat everybody equally. But once you've given somebody an opportunity, and he has refused to do anything with that opportunity, and he merely waits for more and more handout, you don't carry on giving him more and more handouts. You don't treat everybody the same. And if one can understand that with sheep, we'll understand that with people. And so King David has his schooling for leadership in shepherding. And Moshe the same. What would have happened if Moshe would not have made that choice? And he would have chosen rather to keep his sheep near his yeshiva. Do you know what would have happened? Moshe would have been a great scholar, for sure. He would have been near his yeshiva, he would have gone to shiurim every night, he would have studied Torah, he would have been a great rabbinic scholar. But we wouldn't have been given the Torah, because there wouldn't have been a burning bush. It was while Moshe was chasing that goat that he noticed the burning bush. That's when it happened. Had Moshe been in the desert and not chased after the goat, there wouldn't have been a burning bush. He wouldn't have noticed it, it wouldn't have happened. It was while he was making those decisions, which were not religious decisions. Moshe didn't go out looking for bushes. He didn't go out looking for Mount Sinai. He didn't go out looking for God. Or maybe he did. Maybe that's how you do look for God. Maybe pursuing the interests of your employer is the way you look for God. Not sitting and meditating in candlelight with incense burning. That's not how you look for God. The way you look for God is honesty in business. The way you look for God is to go after and take care of the interests of your employer, the interests of your creditors, the interests of your employees, the interests of your customers. That's how you do it. That's where God is. Where does Moshe find God? And when Moshe finds God, that's the people of Israel finding God. That interaction at the burning bush, that was the moment where the Jewish people had their major confrontation with God. That's where the basis for the giving of Torah, that was at Mount Sinai. That's where Moses is told to go and get the people out of Egypt, to bring them back to Mount Sinai, to receive the Torah. So the foundations of the Torah are in that confrontation. What creates that confrontation? Moshe's quest. His quest for what? For God? No! His quest for honesty in business did it. That's what the Torah is about. And King David, where did he find the kingdom? Was he looking for it? Did he go to King College to be trained? No! All he was doing was taking care of his father's sheep and making sure that none of them died. Making sure that there was the highest survival rate. That his father was getting maximum returns on his investment. That was his job. That's where he learned to become king. That's where he was appointed. And what about King Saul? Where was King Saul? Was he lobbying in the corridors of Washington when he became president, when he became king? No, he was in business, taking care of his father's sheep. The question was, what do we do now? Do we give up on the donkeys, not the sheep? Do we give up on the donkeys because my father will start worrying about us? Or do we pursue it further? And the beautiful thing is the way he discusses this with his subordinate, with his servant. And the subordinate says, before we give up, let's go and ask the seer, let's go and ask the prophet. And Shaul says, but we don't have any money. And the subordinate says, I've got a little bit of money. And Saul says, okay, let's go. But it's more than that. The Midrash says the following. Mipnei ma zacho Shaul l'malchus. What got Saul the throne? What was his qualification? Why was he chosen? Answers the Medrash, Bipnei Ha'anova, modesty. Where do we see it? V'do'ag lonu shokal avdoi k'yetzer boi. Look at the most beautiful phrase in verse 5. Hema bol be'eretz Tzuf. They came to the land of Tzuf. V'Shaul omar l'naro, and Shaul said to his young man, Asherimu, who was with him, L'chor v'noshuvo, let us now go back. Let us give up on the donkeys. Pen yechdal ovi min ha'asrenos, lest my father worry about the donkeys, stop worrying about the donkeys, v'do'ag lonu, and worry about us, not me. See that sensitivity? What, his father's going to worry about the servant? The servant's gone looking for the donkeys. That's his job. We know very well the father's going to worry about the son, not about the servant. So the employee's out a little bit late. What would the father say? Good for him. He's working overtime. About time that he puts in puts in a bit of effort for the money I pay him. But what does he say about his son? Where's my boy? Why is he not home yet? I'm worried about him. But Shaul doesn't say that. Shaul doesn't say to his employee, my father will worry about me. It's my father will worry about us. He makes him feel as if he's equally important. And we see it again in the way he relates to the idea, to the advice that the young boy gives him. Let's go to the Re'eh, to the prophet. And Shaul listens, discusses. He says, yes, let's go. And it's that modesty that actually gets him the throne. And so we see that God's valuing of leadership qualities, of course there has to be competence, of course there has to be stature, of course there has to be intellect, but that's not what God looks for in leadership, not that alone. Together with that, and even more so because there's that, because there's intellect, and because there's stature, it's so important that there's modesty as well, that there's sensitivity as well, that there's being in tune, that there's the ability to differentiate, that there's the ability not to treat everybody the same, to notice the needs of individuals, to respond to the needs of individuals. That's what God seeks in that position of royalty. And where does he choose his kings? Not in the yeshivas. Of course, although they're trained, they're great talmidei chachamim, they're great scholars of Torah, of course they are. But that's not where he looks for them. The test of that character is the way he deals in money. That's where it really is. A beautiful Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, that there are three ways you get to know a person. Remember? Kisoi, Kosoi, and Kaasoi. Watch him when he's angry, when he loses his temper, and you'll see the real person. Watch him when he's drunk, and you'll see the real person. It doesn't really mean when he's drunk, it means the way he drinks. If he gets drunk, then you already know. Watch the way he drinks, and you'll see the real person. The kiso, and watch how he spends money. Watch him in business. When it comes to money, that's where you see the character of the person. And when it isn't there in the money area, it doesn't matter what else is there. It's not important. It doesn't say the way you tell character is by how he keeps Shabbos. It doesn't say the way you tell character is about how much he shakes when he davens. It doesn't say you tell character by how long his tzitzis are. Those are all important things. That's not how you tell character. You tell character by the way he drinks, by the way he gets angry, and by the way he deals with money. And God tests leadership with money. God tests leadership in business. God tests leadership when there's a clash between self-interest and the interest of the people you represent, the interests of your constituency. Do you serve your constituency or do you serve yourself? You working for your own, for your master, whether it's your father in this case, or your father-in-law, or an owner, an outside owner, it doesn't matter. That's who you're working for. And you've got to make sure that he maximizes his returns. That's more important than anything. And you don't have a right, even on a religious basis, to do anything that can impair the value of his assets that he's put into your protection. What about these young girls who have this long conversation with him? As he asks, all he does, he says to them, in verse 11, Hayesh Bazeh Hareya, he asks a three-worded question which needs a one-word answer. Does the prophet live in the city? Is the prophet in the city? Answer should be yes or no. What is the answer? Yes, you're lucky, you've just come here, he's just come here, if you're quick you'll find him, because it's a sacrificing day today, the sacrifice is going to be there on the stage, when you come up the town, you'll see him there just before he goes onto the stage to eat, because nobody will eat until he gets there, because he makes the bracha, and everybody says amen, and then they eat, and on this goes a whole story about, so what's it all about, says the Medrash.
Why such a long story? Answers the Medrash very honestly.
They just couldn't stop looking at him. Simple as that. This man was so gorgeous, they couldn't stop looking at him.
So to the unmarried men, if you want to know your status in the market, just stop a young lady and ask her directions and see how long she takes to give you the directions.
This is Israel Kazonis. You're talking about these young girls as if they're prostitutes. Look at the definition of prostitution in the Tanakh. You ask a girl a question that takes one word to answer and she uses 30 words to answer, that's prostitution. Why? What is it? You're making them like prostitutes.
V'haloi k'shem shi'i efshal le'ish lozun es einov mi'isho she'eno ru'uya lo'i kach i efshal le'isho lozun es eineho mi'isho she'eno shelo. A man will never be satisfied looking at a woman that he cannot marry. And a woman will never be satisfied looking at a man who she's not married to.
So what does that make her say? In other words, that can't be the reason. It couldn't be that they were gazing at him. They knew this was Shaul. They couldn't marry him. Weren't married to him. Why would they be doing that? And why is that like prostitution?
Prostitution, the way the Torah sees it, is not something evil. It's something terribly pathetic. Because it is a woman putting herself in a position where she can be treated cheaply. For a woman to make a gesture that can be rejected is hurtful, cheapening, very hard. And therefore when the Medrash says that for them to have engaged in an unseemingly long discussion with the strange man is something they wouldn't have done, because if he wouldn't have responded, they would have felt cheapened. They are putting themselves out. Now, of course, nowadays it wouldn't be the same, because people aren't that careful about how they speak, how long they take to answer. Men-women relationships are not as sensitive, but the principle exists. The principle is that for a woman to put herself out imposes an enormous responsibility on a man not to damage her. For a woman, and that's why women often won't put themselves out, and when they do, they so often get so deeply damaged. For a woman to phone and ask a man for a date. Now, I know that nowadays it's thought that, well, it doesn't really make any difference and everybody's equal, but it does make a difference and everybody isn't equal. The fact is, a man can handle the rejection with less damage, not necessarily less pain, but less damage than a woman can. If a man phones a pretty girl for a date and she says no, it's very painful for the man. But you remember we discussed the size of a man's ego. And that means what gets damaged? His ego gets damaged. With kefalach, men can rebuild the ego very quickly. They don't suffer for long. A woman doesn't have an ego. So when she gets damaged, what gets damaged? It's herself. And that doesn't get repaired. And so men and women aren't the same. They're not equal, they're not the same, and they can't take the same risks. Because the risk isn't the same. And it's therefore important in the dating scene that men understand that. That they cannot expect and should never allow women to put themselves out to that degree because of the enormous potential for not pain and hurt, but for damage. And that men need to be willing to suffer pain so as to avoid damage in the woman. And that's what they mean by prostitution. For a woman to put herself out there, that's prostitution. Running that kind of risk, why would she do it? Why would she engage in a lengthy discussion which would be saying basically, please Shaul, you know, say to me, well, when I'm finished with the prophet, what are you doing this evening? Are you free for dinner? That's what that would mean, that these girls would be doing. They're engaging in conversation in the hope that the conversation would continue. And if it doesn't, where does that leave them? That can't be what it's all about. Therefore, says Rabbi Yossi, Ela shelo higia adayin hasha'a she'amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Shmuel ka'it machar eshlach elech. The time had not yet come. It was not yet exactly 24 hours after the time that God said to Shmuel, in 24 hours time I'm going to send you the next king of Israel, or the first king of Israel. In other words, yes, the psychology of the interaction was these girls couldn't stop gazing at Shaul. But the Medrash says that's unnatural, that they would have risked that long conversation. Yes, it is unnatural. That was God interceding so that Shaul would not get there too soon. The timing of God is absolutely perfect and totally exquisite. When God brings two incidents together at a particular time, that timing is perfect. It isn't one moment off. I remember arriving in Japan once with a 24-hour visa. So I was in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, I arrived, there was nobody in the airport. I came up to the customs officials, there were these long immigration officials, long row of about 20 immigration officials standing at booths, and no passenger except myself. So I had the choice of 20, I choose one. And again, he very politely looks at my passport, he says, you have a 24-hour visa. I said, that's correct. He said, can I see your ticket for exit? I said, sure. I showed it to him. There's some calculations. He says, that's 24 hours and 9 minutes. I said, yes, you're right. The plane was early. It's 24 hours and 9 minutes. He said, please take a seat. And he timed. And 9 minutes later, he said, now you can come. Lahavdil, that's how God works. On the dot of time, absolutely perfect. Why? What difference would it make if Shaul got there a few seconds earlier? The difference is, the Chazal tell us, that when Shaul gets there, Shmuel's reign finishes. It's not just the beginning of Shaul's, it's the termination of Shmuel's. And God won't terminate Shmuel one moment earlier than is decreed, than is the right time. That would be impinging on the rights of Shmuel. That would be undignified for Shmuel. And so God delays Shaul those few moments as he walks up in this pleasant conversation with the young ladies who are on their way out to draw the water, so that the timing should be perfect. As Shaul walks up the steps, Shmuel is walking down the steps. It's exactly 24 hours after Shmuel had had a vision where God had said to him, in 24 hours time I'm going to send you the man. Shmuel walks, here's this magnificent tall individual that he sees in front of him, and Shmuel knows immediately, this is the king, this is the man that God has sent. And Shmuel invites Shaul in, introduces him into some of the roles and feelings of leadership, and at the end of the chapter, at the beginning of the next chapter, takes him aside for the process of anointment, of actually appointing him as king of Israel. And with that we come to the point of transition between the first section of the first book of Shmuel, the setting of the stage, the background. We started off with Eli, the movement into Shmuel, the development of the period of Shmuel, the deterioration of Shmuel's justice system, his son's inability to perpetuate that justice system, the demand of the people that there be a switch from the miraculous type of intervention that God used to lead the people with
to a more natural one. And it's interesting, in this chapter we see the convergence of the natural and the supernatural. The prophet operates supernaturally. God appears to him in a vision and says, in 24 hours' time, to the second, I will present you with the king of Israel. That's supernatural. 24 hours later, if we look at this chapter from Shmuel's perspective, it's all supernatural. 24 hours later, Shmuel is walking down the steps, and there's Shaul walking towards him exactly 24 hours later. Supernatural. If you look at it from Shaul's perspective, it's all natural. Looking after the donkeys get lost, the father says, go and look for them. He goes, he searches, he can't find them, wanders around to the city. His servant says, there's a prophet here, let's go and talk to him. It's all natural. This is the shift from the supernatural method of leadership to the natural method of leadership, which Shaul is going to represent. And at this point, there is the official handing over of the leadership, although the nation do not yet know it, between the two leaders, between the two men, Shmuel and Shaul. Shmuel remains the prophet, but no longer the ruler, no longer the leader, no longer the king. Shaul now becomes the king, and from now on the Jewish people are going to be led by two individuals. The religious conscience, a moral conscience, which will be the prophet, and the political, judicial, and legislative leader, who is going to be the king. And that partnership becomes the study of the rest of this book, through the rule of Shaul, right through the rule of King David, and later on into the rule of King Solomon and the other kings. So with that, we end this series, and I want to thank all of you for your participation. There's been, I need to tell you, a sense of growth in the shiur, not only in the numbers of people attending, but people have commented, and I think justifiably, the quality of people attending. It's not an easy shiur, it's an easy time of night, it's the middle of the week, it's at night, it's a heavy shiur, it's a serious shiur. It's not light entertainment. And the fact that all of you make the effort each Monday night to be here, to study this difficult but fascinating piece of Tanakh, of Jewish history, of God's dealing with us, is enormous credit to you, and it's been an honor and a pleasure to be able to share these insights with you, and I do look forward to doing so again from March the 16th. The shiur tonight was sponsored by a number of people, particularly by Michael and Mary Mann. Some of you might remember that their son Boaz, a couple of months ago, was involved in an accident on Ozone Avenue and was miraculously saved and unhurt seriously in any way. And it's in gratitude to Hashem for his complete recovery, his refuah, that he, together with some of the people on Ozone, namely Esther Simon and her children, the Schaff family, the Abraham family, the Cosman family, and Serena, my wife, and our family, sponsored the shiur tonight in gratitude for that act of what some might say was a coincidence, some might say was a miracle. And as we'll see as we study the book of Shmuel, there's a very narrow line between coincidence and miracle. Those who prefer to believe in the absurd will believe in coincidences. Those who, as difficult as it is, prefer to believe in the rational, will believe in the miracle. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. There is a rather special refreshments, I believe, in honor of Tu Bishvat tomorrow night. I believe there are 15 different kinds of fruit that we've been treated with this evening by Lisa. We invite you to partake of that. Is somebody going to be saying here? Judy, over to you.